In Killer in the Kremlin, award-winning journalist John Sweeney takes readers from the heart of Putin's Russia to the killing fields of Chechnya to the embattled cities of invaded Ukraine. It's been my honour and my pleasure to have John Sweeney on during the past couple of months, and I'm delighted to say he's joining us live in the live from, I believe, from you're in the UK at the moment. John, where are you at the moment?
Yeah, I'm in London, which for the moment hasn't yet been burnt to a crisp. It's completely bizarre. But also another thing, Giles, is that part of the reason why it's been so horribly hot and the planet is burning is because we've been spending too much money on oil and gas, and it's not good for us. So there's a perfectly... our addiction to oil and gas, whether it comes from Saudi Arabia or from Vladimir Putin's Russia, is bad for all of us. And so it's another thing we can do to help the Ukrainians, i.e., you know, let's switch on the nuclear power stations, let's do fracking, let's do coal, let's open up the wind machines. I would love to see, you know, can't we tame the waves? All of those things, we should think very seriously about all of them. Because at the moment, what we're doing is we're giving Vladimir Putin and the Saudi Crown Prince, Mr. Bonesaw, an awful lot of money so they can help burn the planet faster. That's just mad.
Indeed, and also we're seeing this whole thing about weaponizing hunger, which is, if you know your history of Ukraine and Moscow, this goes back to the Stalinist playbook, doesn't it?
Yeah, so I actually wrote a thriller about this called The Useful Idiot, which is actually about the Great Famine of 1933, Stalin's famine, where maybe 7 million people died, 3 million Russians, maybe 4 million Ukrainians. So the idea of, I mean, the Russian Empire, which is how the Ukrainians see it, it has caused mass hunger in this part of the world in living memory. And the idea right now is that by blocking Ukrainian grain shipments to the Middle East and Africa, that Vladimir Putin's playing Hunger Games all over again, just like Stalin. And that's another reason why what we've got to do is help the Ukrainians as best we can.
Now, you know, a lot of people have been saying, oh, well, I didn't realise that Putin was so bad. He thought we were somebody we could do business with, etc. It was better to have Putin in power than the alternatives. But you have been shining a spotlight on Putin for a while now, to put it mildly, since Chechnya, and people talk about the Donbass region, but you were there, of course, with the shooting down of the Malaysian aircraft, and that's some of the most harrowing, the way that you describe that is some of the most harrowing descriptions I've ever heard. So you doorstepped Putin in Siberia with a hangover, went over there and caught him out. So this isn't just saying, oh, isn't Putin an awful person because he's invaded Ukraine? This is systematic methods that he has employed through his tenure. I think we can call that in a light since he's been in Moscow.
Yes. So I first called Vladimir Putin a war criminal in March 2000 because I went to Chechnya undercover and I saw war crimes on a massive scale. And what's frustrating is no one listened to me back then. Then in 22, I'm in Kyiv. The Russian army leaves Kyiv because basically the Ukrainians have kicked them out. And then I see war crime after war crime after war crime. Cars with Yeti spray painted by them, by their owners. Yeti means kids in Russian. And these cars have been shot up with bullets through the windscreen again and again and again. So, you know, dreadful. By the way, let's talk about that hangover.
Yeah.
So it's 2014. Malaysian airline MH17 is shot down. There is 298 people are killed. Malaysians, Dutch, Australians, 10 Brits. It's, as a British terrorist attack goes, it's a big one. It's a big one. It's bigger than some of the so-called Islamic State ones in 2016. But Russia never quite pays the price for this. We work out that he's opening a mammoth museum in Siberia. And I leave my niece's wedding at like 1 in the morning, fly to this place, Yakutsk. It's 9 time zones east of London. It's further east than Beijing. And I rock up. And I'm starving because there hasn't been any proper food on the planes. And I get a kebab, and the kebab is squiffy. Anyway, I get to the Mammoth Museum, and I look like a professor of mammothology, beard, suit, everything. And then then Putin rocks up. He pimprolls in like the little gangster he is, strutting. And I go up to him and say, what about the killings in Ukraine? What about MH17? And he stops, to be fair, and he answers my question. I think he's become more hardened since then. But he gives a very long and entirely dishonest answer, effectively blaming the Ukrainians for everything that's gone wrong, where it's he's the criminal, he's the war criminal. But never mind. In the middle of this, I feel as though the kebab is about to kind of come back up again. And I can see myself going, oh my God, am I about to projectile vomit over the president of Russia? And I stared at him, and he stared at me, and actually he looked away. And I thought if he carried on staring at me, I would have chummed it over him. And to be honest with you, Giles, I didn't vomit over Vladimir Putin, but I regret it now.
But the reason you went to the Mammoth Museum and nine times there was the fact that you knew in Moscow you couldn't pin him down. There would have been no way to get hold of him. So this was completely blindsiding him.
Yes, so that's it. But the point is that actually everything about this book is an argument for democracy. Because what's happened is that Putin has now, he's so successfully eliminated all of the journalists, all of the people who've got a mind of their own, like you and all of your listeners, to the extent that they've either been poisoned or shot, have had to flee the country, or like Navalny, they're in jail. And so there's nobody around who says, listen, boss, don't do this. I don't think the invasion of Ukraine is going to work.
If anybody wants to be stunned into because people listen to podcasts to sort of to relax, to pass away the time, to raise a smile. I've been listening to Taking on Putin. It's been sort of required listening, but I have to be in the right mindset to listen to it, because although it's not an easy listen. And there's one podcast called the underpants poisoner, and if you hear the pain that one of his victims is going through on that flight, and the name escapes me now, it's absolutely horrendous. And at the previous to that, you're talking about Sochi with was he a journalist or was he a mayor standing up against Putin, and he's laughing and you're laughing, and then he's shot a few months later.
Yeah, so that's so the two people we're talking about was Yuri Shakachikhin, was the guy who was investigating the apartment bombs, which was Putin's original sin. He's poisoned, his hair falls out, his skin falls off. His girlfriend goes to see him in his morgue, and she can't see him. She sees an old lady, which kind of reminds her vaguely of her grandma. And she says to the guy in the morgue, where's Yuri? Over there. And it was he looked like an old lady because the poison had changed him. We believe that actually he was poisoned with polonium-210 first, before Litvinenko. The guy who was... So what happened, I went to Sochi in the run-up to the Russian Winter Olympics, and the Putinist mayor of Sochi... An issue was there were no... Was what about... How would gay Olympians be treated? Because there are laws in Russia against talking about being gay. And I said, so how will gays be treated? To the Putinist mayor, and the Putinist mayor of Sochi said, well, there are no gays in Sochi. And then I put this to Boris Nemtsov, and he said, what? He said, there are no gays in Sochi? Then how come there are so many gay bars? And he kept on laughing and laughing and laughing. And so when we put it out on BBC Panorama when I was working at the BBC, we had to trim the laughter because he laughed so long. And then a year later, he was shot dead 100 metres from the Kremlin. And so, he's one of the great Russians who was proof to me, kind of like von Stauffenberg, that there were good Germans. Mm-hmm. The idea all Germans were bad is not true. All Russians are not bad, because look at these people. But so many of them are dead. So many of them are dead.
Where does this all go back to? Is it in your opinion, Putin's DNA then, that he is, his methods are, if you come up against Putin, you end up in a box, or you end up poisoned, or you end up fleeing the country. And even if you flee the country, you're not safe either.
Yeah. So the evidence is strong that there was something very bad happened to Vladimir Putin when he was very, very little. And in my book, Killer in the Kremlin, I interview a guy called Jim Fallon, who is professor of psychiatry at the University of California, who's made a study of the great mass murdering psychopathic dictators Mao, Stalin, Hitler, Putin. And in common, says Jim, is that something catastrophically dark happened to them, whether they were very little. Abuse or abandonment by their natural mother, or both. And he believes that something like this happened to Putin, so that what you've got is when he was 2 or 3 years old, he was like a psychopath acorn growing into a psychopathic oak tree. And what you've got is, and this is common to all of those big four dictators, is an absolute pitiless nature, no empathy for the suffering of others whatsoever, total self-belief, an ability to lie, which is quite astonishing because there is no moral yardstick at all. Whatever they believe is good for them is true. And a fearless dominance, which means that they take extraordinary risks. So that the idea that you can negotiate with this man is absurd. In the book, I go into another character trait, which I think he's got. And the phrase is pleonexia, first identified by a brilliant Russian-American journalist called Masha Gessen. Pleonexia is the irresistible urge to take something which rightfully belongs to another. Ukraine, for example. Or what happens is there's an American billionaire called Robert Kraft who's got he owns the New York Jets or something like this, some great big New York football team. I don't know America. Anyway, he's got a ring on his finger, which is 123 carat. It's worth several million pounds. Putin says, "Can I have a look at that?" Takes it, puts it in his pocket, and then disappears. And then Kraft, this is early days, 2003-04, Putin's on a visit to the States or maybe in Moscow. And the word is that Kraft says it was a gift. But what happened was that Putin nicked it to see what the billionaire's reaction was. He goes to a museum, the Guggenheim Museum in New York, and in the Guggenheim Museum there's a Kalashnikov in glass filled with vodka. Now, basically, this is tourist tat. You can buy it, Giles, for like $400 back then in Moscow. But the Guggenheim made it as a piece of modern art. And he looks in, he says, can I pick that up? And he takes it, aims it, gives it to a bodyguard. The bodyguard leaves the Guggenheim, and he nicks it. So this is the man. Now, the other thing you can do if you've got pleonexia is that you can take other people's peace of mind, not their property, but their peace of mind. You do that by turning up late. The Queen, Putin was late 20 minutes. The King of Spain, an hour. The Pope, 1 hour, 20 minutes. Angela Merkel, 4.5 hours. So the idea that we can sit down and have a negotiated peace. We can say, right, you give us some gas and you can have a bit of the Ukraine. All of that. We're dealing with a man who, if he came to the Costa del Sol, he will say, I want your car. I want your swimming pool. I want your partner. I want your paella. I want your last bit of fucking sangria. He's that kind of person. There isn't, okay, you can take the car. No, I want your wife. He's that kind of man. All we can do is stop him.
Why did the West get it so badly wrong? Was the West, do you think, so desperate then after Yeltsin? Because Yeltsin had a particular style, a peculiar style of government. And so after the interesting times with Yeltsin, then, the West was looking at Putin thinking, well, he seems more sober, buttoned down, and knows what's going on because he's been around.
Yeah, bring back Yeltsin. Bring back the catatonic drunk. What's wrong with alcoholic senility? It's better than what this guy is. It really is. So there was an anxiety about Yeltsin because he would get drunk. Would he hit the nuclear button by mistake? But only ever by mistake. And I don't believe the Russian system would have allowed him to have done that. But what we've got is a psychopath who from the age of 2.5, something like this, has hated every other human being on earth, pretty much. And that's the thing. But I think the answer, the wider answer to your question is that two things have happened. Is that Western leaders, to be fair to them, love trading and dealing and compromising. It's what they do. It's how they've got to where they are in politics. And that's perfectly reasonable. I.e., you've got a difficult person. You try and deal with them. And then it goes away, and then we can go back to worrying about all the other things we've got to worry about. Putin's not like that, and so there's a category mistake. He's outside the normal box that democratic leaders are used to, and they keep on not getting that right. And the second thing is money. So what's happened in particular the City of London, but this is also true of Spain, of all of the European economies and the states, is that there's been an awful lot of Russian dark gold that has arrived in the West, and the City of London in particular has got a brilliant fog machine, which is basically, it enables the Russian dark gold to hide its true origin. And so, you know, these yachts and villas and bars and football teams that the Russian oligarchs and Putin's proxies have bought for Putin, it's hidden. We don't know who owns it because nobody knows who owns this stuff. And so, yes, the Western politicians were afraid to stand up to him, was kept on giving him the benefit of the doubt, but also they like the money.
I do a phone-in show for my sins on a Tuesday called Viewpoint, and we talk about issues of the day. It's a two-hour show. People are about to phone in, and there's no filter on it, so people can phone in. And when I throw open the faders, I have no idea what will come in. And one of the things that I have heard is that, and people are saying this, and when you reply to this, John, can you just put a filter on it, please? Because we are live, okay? I'm just warning you. But I hear this. You say, well, Western leaders wanted to deal with him because this, that, and the other. And I have had calls in from people who say, yeah, but Putin is you know, the whole thing, the situation with Ukraine was Ukraine's fault. They would get, of course, NATO was going to react like this. They're going to have nuclear missiles on Russia's doorstep. And Putin is fighting the globalists. Now, keep it clean when you reply. So if you could, people are saying that, you know, Putin is actually standing up for a sovereign Russia. He's got every right to defend his country in whatever ever means he can. What would you say to those people, John, having met the man and seen what has happened in Russia over the past 20 years?
Well, I'd be interested to know how many people who say that. But essentially, I think in any democratic society, 1 out of 10 are always a bit fascistic. And so the part of that is background noise that you get in democracy. Where it gets scary, whether it becomes 2 out of 10 or 3 out of 10 or 4 out of 10, and then things become dark. In particular, if the liberal majority, the 6 out of 10 or the 7 out of 10, is divided against itself. And that's how this stuff can come through. But essentially, the idea that there is a kind of a Soviet orb of power, that was first promulgated in August 1939, when you had the Nazi-Soviet Pact. George Orwell called it the midnight of the century. When Adolf Hitler and Joseph Stalin agreed that Eastern Europe would be half Nazi and half Soviet. And that was wrong, full stop. The Soviet idea was wrong because it needed the Cheka, the forerunners of the KGB, to murder people to keep it in power. It never, ever won a democratic vote. And effectively, under Stalin, it became a kind of Russian empire thing with a shiny ideology which was entirely opposed to the reality. Ukraine has slowly fought its way, voted and fought its way out of the Russian imperialistic umbrella. And Putin, because he's got this ferocious dark nostalgia for how things used to be once it's back. He was once asked what was the greatest geopolitical disaster of the 20th century. And he says it's the fall of the Soviet Union. Well, that's just crazy. The First World War, the Second World War, the Holocaust. But so I want to say to those listeners, you know, you really, really are talking rubbish. You don't understand that. It's quite simple. I have been to Bucha, which is a suburb of Kyiv, and after the Russian army left, we got there, and there were two civilians in the back garden, one of whom had been shot in the back of the head, the other guy had been shot in the front of the head. And these war crime after war crime, civilians executed. something like 7 out of 10 people who were killed in Bucha were executed, not hit by artillery. That happens in war. They were executed. And again, the thing is that, like, if somebody comes up to you, a gangster, I'd like to say to these people who say this, okay, I want your car. And then they give me that, because if you don't give me your car, I'm going to hurt you. And I own the police. I own the journalists. There's nothing you can do. I want your car. Thank you. I've got the keys to the car. Now I want your wife. And now I want your house. And now I want everything. So it doesn't stop until you say to this guy, no, go away.
Go away.
Right. Yeah. That's how it is. And they've got to understand that, because this guy will keep on taking everything we've got, our peace of mind, our sense of right and wrong, everything, unless we stand up to him.
Where are we in the Ukraine? I mean, listening to you, the latest pod, one of the most recent podcasts last night, you know, we've entered a stage of the war. They didn't walk into Kyiv with, as they thought, babushkas throwing flowers on the tanks as they came in single file. We're in, as you say, Ukraine needs heavy metal, not just 12 pieces or 12 pieces there, because they're facing 12,000, as the man who famously arrested you for being a spy once said, and is now one of your best mates, John. I've got 4 minutes, so off you go.
So what happened is, if your listeners don't know the story, on day two of the war, I was filming everything, because I've got Patreons and you need to feed the beast. I'm filming everything. And basically, suddenly, Ukrainians have switched from being in the Shire, happy, dancing, drinking, to we're going to fight this thing. And there was a real anxiety about Russian spies. And I was filming some soldiers. I stopped filming. And then I stopped filming. And then I started filming some more. And this guy arrested me. And I said, do I look like a Russian spy? So Giles, never argue with a man with a loaded machine gun.
True.
And I put my hands up. And then they arrested me, and they phone up the Ukrainian intelligence SBU, and I'm booked in, and they're going to check me out. So it's heavy, heavy. And then Vlad Demchenko, if you're on Twitter, you can follow him, is Broken Pixel UA. He's great. But anyway, he looks me up on Google, and he sees that I've doorstep Vladimir Putin. And then I've also challenged Donald Trump. And then he realizes that he's made a mistake. But it's too late now, because I'm plugged into the system. And then he looks at me and he says, I think you have an interesting story. Anyway, we become great friends. But he's on the front line. I've got a family wedding. My son's getting married.
Congratulations.
Well, later this month, and my wedding present, I'm not giving them anything else, but my wedding present is not to be in a war zone in the month they're getting married. There's enough, you know, worrying about the drinks arriving on time, etc. So they don't want the fool of a dad missing somewhere. But in August, I'm going to go back, and I'm going to hang out with Vlad and go towards the front line. I'm too old to go on the front line, but you can drift towards it, and you can hear it, and then you get a sense of how it's going. But essentially, the good news is that the Ukrainian heavy metal, sorry, the American heavy metal, particularly this HIMARS system, is arriving. Basically, it can throw 40 miles. The Russian artillery can throw 15 miles. So it's like a boxing match. When the Ukrainians now, who've been on the ropes for a time, have now got the ability to hit, and the Russians can't hit them back. Mm. And what they've done with that, very smartly, because they're clever people, is they've knocked out 12 big, enormous ammo dumps. So what happens is the Russians put the ammo in trains and then send it into Ukraine next to a kind of enormous, imagine a kind of B&Q warehouse or whatever, an IKEA warehouse full of shells. And then they are put into lorries and taken to the front line. What the Ukrainians done has smashed these things. And so the Russian rate of fire has gone right down. The Ukrainians can win this thing.
Just wanted, because I've only got a minute and 40, and I could talk to you, as you know, for hours. We've done it before. But just Vlad and everybody else in the Ukraine, and the reporter who was standing in for you, whose name escapes me, the brilliant female reporter who was a dentist, but an economist before, how are they all doing?
So Lisa Kozlenko she's a clinical, she used to test the integrity of drug trials so that they were good. And all the time during the war, she kept on supplying drugs to people who needed them in difficult places. Completely brilliant. She's great. I'm talking to her later today.
Evgeny, how's the worst translator in the world?
He's working with an American who is building up evidence about war crimes. So he goes to the front line, he wears the kit, he's doing great work. Vlad the driver is driving around Kyiv. They're all still alive, you know, touch wood. They're all brilliant people, and they've taught us a big thing. Democracy must be defended. Free speech does not come free.
This book is called Kill It in the Kremlin. John, if people want to support you and follow you, where do they find you?
I'm on Twitter at John Sweeney Raw. I've got a Patreon, which is also Patreon John Sweeney Raw, or just buy the book. I've also done the audio book, so you can listen to my frankly growly voice and being very rude about Vladimir Putin.
And great to see the orange hat is being worn in the London heat wave.
Yeah, I'm doing it for you, mate.
John Sweeney, Killer the Kremlin, thank you so much for your time today.